From New Hampshire Public Radio and the Howe Library in Hanover, New Hampshire, you're listening to Check This Out, a new literary series where we dive deeply into the works of emerging and diverse authors you may not have discovered yet. I'm your host, Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novel Atomic Anna. I am thrilled to be able to share these conversations with you over the next few weeks. Later in this series, we'll be hearing from Leo Vardashvili and Obrey Lescure, to name just a few of the authors that will be joining us. But today on this show, my guest is Maura Cheeks, and I am so excited to bring her to you today. She is the author of the brand new novel, Acts of Forgiveness. This is her debut, set in a slightly speculative America, in a world where the government has approved reparation payments for Black Americans, if they can prove they are descended from slaves. To tell the story, she focuses on the Revel family as they struggle to keep their family construction business afloat while retracing their lineage. Throughout the book, Cheeks asks, can forgiveness be political and can it be lasting? This is the big, big question that stayed with me long after I put the book down. Can forgiveness be political and can it be lasting? With the Revel family, Maura shows us people praying, hoping, rooting for the forgiveness act, and those fighting against it, sometimes violently. I'm really, really excited to have you here today, and there is so much to discuss in this book that I had a hard time figuring out where to start. But I think we're going to start with the very, very basics. So this book centers around the Forgiveness Act, which is about reparation payments. So what is that? Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, so the Forgiveness Act imagines that the country, so the Forgiveness Act has passed the House and the Senate, and they have approved a certain amount of funds to be allocated to Black Americans if they can provide the necessary documents to show that their ancestors were enslaved in the country.
So that's a really, really big theme and can start us down some really big conversations. But where I wanted to start was I read that this whole idea for the novel really started with your work that you did for The Atlantic and an article that you published there called American Wealth is Broken. And in this article, you examine the wealth gap between Black and white Americans. And then you wrote, this is one of my favorite things that you wrote in there, closing the wealth gap sounds like an abstract policy agenda, but it's really about giving more people the power to choose how to care for themselves and their families. There's no such thing as an individual success story. So can we start there and talk about that and the wealth gap and how that got you to the book?
Yeah, sure. I started writing that article in 2019. And I think, you know, I was going deep on the research of the wealth gap and what has led to this disparity of the average white family having six times as much wealth as the average Black family. And, you know, I got to a point when I was finished writing the article where I still had so many questions, right, of why we haven't been able to address these systemic inequalities in our country. And I came to the decision to continue exploring those questions through fiction. And just understanding that, you know, the wealth gap and some of these inequalities that we've been wrestling with are not going to magically wish themselves away. And so I wanted to explore the route taken if we as a country chose to enact a larger federal policy to address the racial wealth gap as one specific example. And so for me, I think exploring the question, the book sort of starts at not if we decide as a country to enact the policy, but what happens after we do it. So I think one thing that was important for me was to get to a point of, you know, we've already made the decision to enact the policy. And so it's less about grappling whether we should and more about, okay, how does that actually come to life? And what does that mean for one family?
Yeah, which is fascinating. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. But I want to stick for another minute or two on the wealth gap and really where this book started. And one of the sentences in particular, I want to go back to where you said, there's no such thing as an individual success story. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it's hard to separate it for me because I think part of what I wanted to explore with reparation, the topic of reparations, is the spiritual aspect of it in addition to the financial. And so when you think about there's no such thing as an individual success story, the people who have benefited from wealth over generations do so because of a lot of different factors, many of which are not due to their work alone, right? Maybe they inherited money from their family. Maybe they were a family who received land in the Homestead Act. Maybe a grandfather benefited from the GI Bill. So there's many different ways that people end up becoming successful, and it's not due to only their work. And so for me, I was interested in digging a little bit deeper into that aspect.
But as you pointed out in your Atlantic article, you know, we talk about this mythos around, you know, starting a company in your parents' garage. Well, that's really, we're talking about white middle class suburban garages where these companies are coming out of, and you're not talking about a Black person starting it in the projects, right? And that is really, that hit home to me as this is the gap. This is what you're trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
That juxtaposition, right? When we think about it, we think about somebody starting a company like Apple or Microsoft in a garage, but they have this whole family and, you know, this wealth that they can fall back on, this middle class pillow, as it were, and a garage that exists that you can go into. And that it's very hard to have that and to go start Apple or Microsoft, right? If you are working at Wawa or 7-Eleven or whatever, 50, 60 hours a week.
You know, I just wanted to explore this idea of having sort of the mental space to dream and who is afforded that that privilege. And I think the mythos we have around the tech startup and the tech founder, it's formed in this basis of they did have something to fall back on. And, you know, what happens if you don't have that? And how much harder is it to reach that mythical pinnacle of success?
All right, so let's dive into the book and let's talk about Acts of Forgiveness and the Revel family, because they are also building a business, right? And you take us into a family that is trying to start something from nothing, in a sense. So tell us, introduce us to the Revels.
Yeah, so we meet the Revels as the country is about to pass the Forgiveness Act, which is the nation's first federal reparations bill for Black families. And so the Revels are dealing with a struggling family business when they are receiving this news about the Forgiveness Act. And so we meet them as they're grappling with these two things of trying to secure their legacy with their family business and also wanting for many reasons to believe in the Forgiveness Act and retrace their lineage as part of the act requires in order to be eligible for the funds.
And you put us in this tenuous moment for the family because the business looks to be doing well, but in fact, they are in the hole and they're struggling and it's right on the edge. And the dad who's been running the business for a long, long time is about to hand it over to his daughter. And she's not really sure she wants that. To introduce us to the Revel family, I was hoping you could read a short passage where you plop us into the moment, right, the turning point for the family, where they're really facing the big question of how are we going to save this business? Would you mind reading for us?
Sure. "I want you to work in the business," Max said. "I want you to start now so you can learn closely how the business works. But I'm a journalist. I'm going to be promoted soon. And my professor, Elizabeth Johnson, do you remember I told you about her? She's going to run for senator. She wants me to work on her campaign." They looked at her sympathetically, as if what she was saying was the furthest thing from a reality they cared anything about. "The idea will be for you to take over MRA, Max said. "I thought you'd be excited about that. It's what you wanted. When I was 15. All I built will go away unless you step in. This is your legacy."
I thought this was so powerful. Thank you for reading that, because this is the moment where Willie Revel really faces the turning point Is she going to step in and save the family business, right, and be there for her family? Or is she going to be the journalist that she's always dreamt about being? And I think this is really where we get to a lot of what you've written about in terms of the wealth gap and having something to fall back on. Because if she doesn't step in, then the entire business will fall apart. So can you just talk to us about that moment and what's going on with Willie?
Yeah, I mean, I think, she's grappling with whether she can pursue her own dreams or whether she needs to continue working in the family business, which she knows that her father has sacrificed a lot to make successful, and her family depends on it financially. And so she is grappling with this, she feels and is made to feel, a selfish decision to pursue her dreams versus, you know, really continuing a legacy. And for the Revels, it's not just about, oh, a family business. It's, you know, her dad was blocked from getting into the union initially because he was Black. And so he really had to work hard to make that happen. There have been a ton of sacrifices, right, that make it possible for the business to succeed. And so she is really trying to decide if she can look away from that for her own desires.
And one of the really beautiful aspects of this book is that Willie, the character, and the Revel family are written with a hand that made me feel like it was so personal and so deep for you. And we're going to dig right into that. But if you're just joining us today, my guest here on Check This Out is Maura Cheeks. You're listening to New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, your host. Maura, thanks so much again for joining us. I really want to go back into the Revel family and Willie, and we're just starting to dive into this big choice she has to make, this decision whether she follows her own dream or she helps the family and she comes home and saves the family business. And I mentioned that it felt very personal to me. I felt like I was reading your life. And then I read about your life a little bit after the book. Can you talk about those parallels and how personal this story is for you?
Yeah, my grandfather did start a construction company. My mom works in it. And so I do want to preface it is fiction, but I did pull from a lot of influences in my family. And yeah, I think this idea of a family business, especially a Black family business, is very personal. There's a lot of sacrifices that went into building it. And so I'm interested in, especially being a writer, which sometimes can feel, it's a dream to be able to write a book, right? And so I think grappling with this idea of pursuing your dreams and what that means, but then also making sure your family is okay, especially given all of the things that they've sacrificed. And so for Willie in the book, it's really about making that choice and how she makes that choice and what that means for the family.
And so I can see that personal connection very clearly on every page. I felt like your heart was there, which is the kind of book that we all love to read. But I also wanted to ask you then, how did you get from that, you know, putting your family on the page to the Reparations Act, to the act of forgiveness? How did you decide to add that, you know, to the mix, which is obviously not happening in real life at the moment, but this idea of the Forgiveness Act, how did you get there?
Yeah, I mean, I think after I wrote the article for The Atlantic, I was really interested in exploring reparations more deeply. And I think a lot of time with reparations, it gets bogged down in statistics and numbers, and it becomes a very charged political debate. And so I was interested in focusing on a family and really getting away from the numbers and focusing on the personal aspect and bringing some humanity back into the conversation of, like, what would this actually mean for one family? Not just financial, but also emotionally, spiritually. I was just interested in bringing some humanity back to the conversation and getting away from numbers and hopefully helping readers fall in love with these characters so that then they can look at reparations in perhaps a different light.
this is, it, you know, for many people, it is still a very abstract idea, the act of the forgiveness act, right? Reparations. And then in the book, you put a number on it, right? And you say, this is the number that, you know, everyone will receive, all Black Americans who can prove that they're descended from people who were enslaved. You know, this is what they will be awarded if you can prove that lineage. And you show that there are lots of people in favor of it and lots of people opposed to it. And you show the two sides, and you laid those two arguments out. Can you take us through those?
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of research for the book, and there are many ways that reparations on a federal level could come to light. And so I was exploring, here's one way that this could work. It's not the only way, but I was interested in exploring, like, If families were to get one sum, and if this were the number, what would the reaction be among families of across the political spectrum? And, you know, with any, since 2020, I started writing the book in 2019, which the world in the course of writing it was changed forever. And so, you know, suddenly this sort of abstract idea of reparations that I was writing about in 2019, suddenly it was in the public conversation in a way that it wasn't when I first started writing the book. And so some of that influenced my ability to imagine what would be the range of reactions to this type of bill.
Yeah. And you also explain very well in the book that, you know, it's not just about reparations for slavery alone, that wasn't just the end of it, right? That there are a lot of other inequalities that Black Americans face. Can you take us through some of those and what some of your characters really talk about in the book?
Yeah, so the book starts with Willie's grandfather being denied the benefits of the GI Bill. And so that's just one example that I start with to sort of build on from there in terms of that being one example of why Max's business perhaps doesn't have the greater cushion that it might have otherwise had if his father had received certain benefits and was able to start building wealth. I think there's a misconception that reparations only applies to slavery. And what I explore in the book is that actually, a federal reparations program would deal with the consequences of slavery, but also Black Americans being denied the benefits of the GI Bill, the consequences of redlining, the consequences of not receiving Social Security benefits because they were denied to certain classes of workers and Black people were more likely to hold those jobs. So there are a range of ills that a federal reparations program would aim to address, mainly the ongoing ramifications of discrimination that Black Americans experienced from slavery through Jim Crow and beyond.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on NHPR. My guest today is Maura Cheeks, and we are talking about her debut novel, Acts of Forgiveness. Maura, thanks again for joining us. We are digging into this idea of reparation payments and the Forgiveness Act that you write about in your very powerful novel. And we were talking a little bit about the arguments in favor and why people are so excited about it, particularly the Revel family, your family that you focus on. But you also show us that there are people opposed to reparation payments, people who stand around saying, well, I had nothing to do with slavery. So, you know, they don't want to have anything to do with incurring national debt to make these payments, and it turns violent. Can you talk about some of that opposition in the book as you imagine it?
Yeah, I imagine the range of emotions that people experience in terms of not wanting to pay for reparations. So there's the tax side of things where people are wondering, how is this being funded? I'm not paying for this. I had nothing to do with slavery. And then there's the sort of middle ground reaction where people believe that, yes, what the country did was wrong. Black people experienced discrimination, but it is not the country's responsibility to pay for that. and there's other ways to deal with inequalities. There's a character in the book named Hank who believes that his company is doing better work because they treat Black people equally and they hire some Black people. So everything's fine. It's all good. And then there's people who believe that apologizing is enough and money is neither here nor there. So I try to explore a range of different responses that I imagine could happen if something like this were to pass.
And above all of these emotions is this question, can forgiveness be political? And can it be lasting? And that is the question, as I've said, that has just stayed with me throughout the book since I put it down. And I would love to hear you talk about that. Can forgiveness be political? And can it be lasting?
Yeah, I think this is not a spoiler. The president in the book is a woman, and she believes that her ancestor is directly responsible for, you know, reversing Sherman's order. And so I started asking that question because I was imagining what would have to be true for the U.S. to get to a point where we're passing a federal reparations bill. And then I imagined, well, you know, potentially it would be someone in power who feels like a deep sense of responsibility for some of the inequalities that Black Americans face or experience. And so that's where I got to with it being President Elizabeth Johnson, who is in the book, who's really pushing the Forgiveness Act forward because she has extreme white guilt, essentially. And she feels a deep personal responsibility to make things right.
But how do you legislate forgiveness?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason that I called it the Forgiveness Act is because part of the work of forgiving falls on the person who's forgiving. So the burden is still on, you know, the party who has been harmed in some way. And so we see this with Black families being asked to show documents to prove they deserve the money. So there's a lot of work that has to go into being quote unquote eligible for forgiveness, which is ironic, right? Because if you are asking for forgiveness, there's some sort of feeling that you shouldn't have to be doing so much work to get to that point. There's a point in the book where Willie is sort of grappling with this notion that the government has never truly done anything that's beneficial for Black people. There's always sort of a catch to it, and so that's what we sort of see in the book with the Forgiveness Act, which is that it's not just as simple as the president signing on the dotted line and it's all good.
That was a searing statement. I got chills when you said, you know, proving your eligibility for forgiveness. I mean, no matter, you know, in the book, we're talking about proving lineage from enslaved people. But, you know, I mean, any kind of proving that you are worthy of forgiveness is a heartbreaking idea. And part of where you really, really, I think, pull the reader into the novel, into the Revel family's world and make us feel that pain for them. If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum, and you're listening to Check This Out on NHPR. My guest today is Maura Cheeks, and we are talking about her debut novel, Acts of Forgiveness. And right now, we are going to really dig into this idea of how you prove your eligibility for forgiveness. I mean, just even saying that hurts. Like, it's hard to say that, right? To think about, you know, I have to convince you that I'm worthy of it. Did it hurt to write that? You know, to put that in there?
Yeah, I mean, the point is too, right? They're not the ones being forgiven, so there's always a sort of irony throughout, which I think is interesting and necessary to explore, because there would have to be some proof requirements if something like this were to pass. And so part of the reason reparations is even, I think, important is that getting those documents is really hard, because the history and the personhood of enslaved people has been wiped away purposefully. And that's also part of what inspired me with the book, is because when I was retracing my own family's history, pretty much we can only go back as far as Kentucky, and that's it. And so I'm interested in knowing more about where I come from, and the inability to do that yet is part of what drove me to write about reparations.
So you traced your own family to Kentucky in what year?
By trace, I mean spoke with my grandmother. Like, she told me stories, and then I did some, you know, loose genealogical research on my own side, just based on what she could remember and what we could find online.
So in the book, Willie Revel goes down south. She goes to Mississippi, and she tries to dig into whatever records are possibly available to figure out if her family was enslaved and where the family split, and basically what was hiding. And can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
For the book, I went to Mississippi, and I did that research and pretended that I was Willie and going through the process. And I worked with the employees of the archives and the Historic Natchez Foundation. And it was an incredible experience. And I think, I tried to highlight a journey where the answers aren't clear. And I think anyone who's tried to do genealogical research knows that there's a lot of dead ends. It's very complicated, especially for Black people to get the records that they need in order to continue tracing their lineage. And so I wanted to mimic that with Willie's journey in terms of having to go down there, trying to find the records and actually see the records. And then everything sort of coming together, but not really. And so, yeah, I think it was important for me to mimic what an experience might be like for somebody who has pieces here and there and is just trying to retrace all that she can.
Did you look for your own family records? Could you trace your family back?
There's really not much. So I've tried, and I will probably keep trying. But it's hard to find.
I hear a little bit of frustration, and I understand that. And I think that you really, really bring that point home in the book when you show us Willie's daughter, Paloma, who is sitting in class, and it's one of her first days at school, and she's at this very fancy private school on scholarship, and the teacher says, "Let's get to know each other. I'd like you to write about your lineage and draw some flags," talking about where your family came from. And she is the only Black student in the class, and she refuses to do it, right? She doesn't do it. Can you tell us about that moment and what happens?
Yeah, that was actually partially inspired by an essay in the 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah Jones, where she had a similar exercise that she went through. But I framed it around the Forgiveness Act, because with the passing of the Forgiveness Act, a lot of people are talking about retracing their lineage. And so the teacher thinks that it would be a fun experiment to try and teach the kids about their history. Paloma feels uncomfortable because her classmates are drawing an Italian flag and flags of various countries. And she only knows America, right? And she knows that this is where her family's from. And yet she feels uncomfortable participating because she feels as though something's missing. And later, you know, we have Willie. She does a DNA test that she gets the results back from. And, you know, there's different percentages in across Africa. And she feels also unsatisfied with this. And so from a personal standpoint, you know, I've gotten questions in terms of, where are you from? Meaning not just a satisfactory answer isn't a state in America. They're looking for, where are you from beyond America? And I have to say, I don't know. And it's always a little bit uncomfortable. And so that's where that part of the book kind of came from.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum, and you're listening to Check This Out. My guest today is Maura Cheeks, and we are talking about her debut novel, Acts of Forgiveness. We are on a journey right now with the Revel family. They are based in Philadelphia, and they have a family construction business. And we are set in a time where Maura has imagined the U.S. government has passed the Forgiveness Act. And we are talking about reparations for Black Americans. Maura has also written extensively for The Atlantic about the fragility of Black wealth. And she shows us this when we look at the Revel family and their house. And this is one of my favorite pieces in the book, when we see the Revel family moving from Hoarder Street to a fancier section of Philadelphia to 512 Loire Street. So can you talk to us about this move and tell us about this big change in their life?
Yeah, the house plays a really big role in the book. It symbolizes for them upward mobility. It symbolizes comfort and safety, physical safety, but also emotional safety. So it is almost another character in the book, I was thinking when I was writing it, because it means so much to all of them, but for different reasons. And I think anyone who has had a home that they really feel is special to them, I hope this resonates in terms of, you know, wanting to preserve it for many different reasons. And it's not just a house. It means so much to them for so many different reasons.
And it was a very powerful symbol of their wealth, but also the fragility. And we're going to get to that in a minute, but I want to talk about 512 Loire Street. So I grew up in Philadelphia, as my listeners probably know. Hoarder Street is real. And I'd never heard of Loire Street, so I Googled it. And the Google machine brings me back to Villa Loire. So I'm assuming this is your inspiration?
Yeah, and so Loire Street is fictional, and it was the name of Madam C.J. Walker's estate, and Madam C.J. Walker was one of the first wealthy Black Americans, and so for me, it was a symbol of status and wealth and success and what that meant for the rebels.
And I was reading that she really used this villa as a gathering place for a lot of notable leaders of the Harlem Renaissance. And you have those same kind of parties happening in the book.
Yeah, I think for the rebels, it became an extension of their power to bring people together in their previous home. But it's bigger, there's more space, it becomes a place where prominent people in the city come to. And so it, for them and for Willie, symbolizes something powerful, right? That their family is really ushering in a new era and really helping to connect people and share ideas and affect change.
So the house, 512 Loire Street, really is a huge symbol and a character in the book. It is the center of the family in many ways, but then they're about to lose it, right? That fragility of wealth for the family, of Black wealth in general, is really also embodied in that house. So can you take us to that?
Yeah, I think for a lot of Black Americans with a positive net worth, a lot of their wealth is wrapped up in home ownership. And that becomes a really tough thing to navigate when your home means a lot. It's not as simple as just, okay, we sell it and now we have money and can do what we want. Of course, that is an incredible amount of freedom and privilege to be able to do that. But it also is emotional. And so for the rebels, it becomes this decision of, you know, we have this house and there's a reason we have this house. It's so that we have a cushion. But then they're really grappling with what that means to lose it and what happens after they let it go.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on NHPR. And my guest today is Maura Cheeks. We are talking about her debut novel, Acts of Forgiveness. Maura, I want to dig a little bit more into the fragility of Black wealth and your personal connection to that, because the rebels were, you know, at a tipping point and they were thinking about selling the house. I'm not going to give any spoilers and say what happened, if they had to give up Loire Street or not. But that's personal to you, isn't it?
Yeah, my family, you know, we ended up moving out of a house that I grew up in that I adored. And so that really shaped me in terms of what that means when your wealth is wrapped up in homeownership, and the sort of emotional toll that can take in terms of leaving your home, and even just the significance of what a home means. Because I think as an adult, you sort of get to a point where maybe the physical house is less important eventually. But I think it can always be emotional to have to leave your home, right? And so for me, that was an important moment in my life. We moved when I was a junior in high school. And so in some sense, like my writing has revolved around that a lot because I've been trying to make sense of what does a home really mean? It's the physical, but it's not the physical. And why is it so emotional? And so that really shaped that part of the book.
But one of the breaks, you know, with the Rebel family and your own life, of course, is your father. He is the famous NBA Hall of Famer player coach, Maurice Cheeks, Mo Cheeks. And you write about how a lot of people would say to you, oh, of course, he's, you know, rich black people play sports. And you grew up with that stereotype hanging over you. But at the same time, you're watching your family, you know, with a family business, you know, working. And as all family businesses have ups and downs, can you talk about that juxtaposition and that, you know, those comments that you would get?
Yeah, I think part of the struggle in even writing this book is when you think about reparations, in some sense, a lot of people disqualify me from the conversation even because of I was so privileged the way I grew up. And I know that. And so, you know, it's something that I wanted to explore in the book is that nuance of a family that has quote unquote made it. It looks a lot different to be a wealthy black family than a wealthy white family a lot of times. And the sort of generational aspect of that in terms of having wealth and money and properties to fall back on, right, exists in a very different way for wealthy black families who are one or two generations or even three generations, as opposed to some, you know, white families who are five, six, seven generations in terms of the wealth that they've been able to build.
I would love to lean into your point there that there is a difference in the generational wealth, right? And that really leads us to this wealth gap between black and white families.
Yeah, I think this comes to life a lot with Paloma. And I don't want to give away any spoilers, but we see in her story what it can mean professionally to have a little bit of a cushion and what she potentially is able to do and to achieve knowing that there's some support there. And so, yeah, I'm fascinated by the stories we tell ourselves around American success and how those people have gotten to those places and why other people haven't. And that's what I'm interested in exploring in a lot of my writing in terms of, just sort of generational support financially and emotionally and from the government and sort of what we're able to achieve as a result of that.
Yeah. I mean, you've written about for you personally and your family how your father, when he first started in the NBA, was sending a big chunk of his salary back to his mom, who was still living in the south side of Chicago.
What I wrote about in the Atlantic article was one example of my dad, for instance, sending money home to make sure that his mom was okay versus other people who maybe were getting that amount of money could put it into homeownership or put it into other asset building enterprises.
Well, for the Revel family, they are really struggling with their business itself and they are digging into their ancestry, to history. They're deep in Mississippi, and we are going to come back to them in just a moment. My guest today is Maura Cheeks. She is the author of the brand new novel, Acts of Forgiveness. And we are talking about the world that she has imagined in which the Forgiveness Act passes and reparations are being paid to Black families that can prove lineage, prove that they are descended from people who were enslaved in the South. So this, as we've talked about, is a very, very personal book. Did you find yourself, you know, so buried in the emotion of this book that at times it was hard to push forward?
Yes and no. I think in 2020, when everything was happening and the world was on fire, George Floyd was murdered, and I found it necessary to write. It really, the events of that time really pushed me to finish the book. You know, I was writing a topic that was very personal, and the family dynamic was very personal, but I felt compelled to finish the book because it felt in many ways bigger than me, even though that sounds cheesy.
It doesn't sound cheesy. I think that sounds spot on. And it leads directly to my next question, which is, are you getting a lot of pushback? Are people scared of this book?
I'm encouraged by the response. You know, there have been a couple of local reparation policies that have passed in Evanston, and they just formed a task force in Philadelphia. So, you know, those are very encouraging, and they didn't exist when I first started writing the book. So the landscape is totally different. And people seem really hopeful with the book, which is encouraging.
That is amazing. So when you say hopeful, what does that mean?
I think people are interested to know what it could look like. I think the response to it has been less of, that's a crazy thing to write about, and more, well, what does that actually look like? More about the details of that type of policy.
And when you think about this policy of Forgiveness Act, reparations becoming reality, what keeps you up at night? What scares you about it?
I mean, I'm not a policy expert, so take everything with a grain of salt. I'm a fiction writer. But, you know, I think I'm encouraged by the local policies that have passed. I think what keeps me up at night is whether the local policies that are passing would prevent a federal policy from moving forward, and whether it sort of becomes, well, look at all of these different initiatives that are happening. We don't need anything on the federal level. And that's where I think about, well, what is lost if we don't, as a country, acknowledge what happened in the past and make amends.
So you're not a policy wonk or policy specialist, but you do have an MBA. And you definitely used that when looking into some of these policies. And I don't get many people with an MBA on this show. So how did that help you while you are, you know, writing this book, or as you're in your career as a writer?
It helped me realize I didn't want to be a consultant. Yeah, I mean, it helped me really get in touch with why I wanted to write, and that I wanted to pursue writing. And I'm opening a bookstore, so it's helping with that.
You are opening a bookstore. Congratulations. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm opening a bookstore bar in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, named Liz's Book Bar after my grandmother, Elizabeth.
Well, I cannot wait to go there. And I'm sure we have many listeners who will also be there when your doors open. If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on NHPR. And my guest today is Maura Cheeks. We're talking about her debut novel, Acts of Forgiveness. So Maura has a lot going on. She has a new bookstore that she's opening soon, and she has her debut novel out. And I'm wondering what kind of advice you have for new writers.
I hated getting this advice when I was writing, but it really is just to write every day. So that is my advice, is to write something every day, even if that is not literally writing. It could be reading something that's inspiring you. It could be researching a scene you're working on, but to somehow move whatever project you're on forward just a little bit every day.
Even if it's bad writing, just sit down and write.
Yeah, I mean, I think connected to that, then the other advice is getting clear about what you want. Do you want to publish a book? Do you want to write it and never publish it, which some people are fine with? Do you want to self-publish, and why you want to do that?
What has been the hardest sort of part of this project of getting this book to publication, to the market? What has been the hardest part for you?
I rewrote it about 7 times before I sent it to my agent. So that was hard because I didn't know if I would ever finish it. And I kept sort of getting to a point where I wrote it. And then I would say, no, I need to do more genealogy research. Or no, I need to know more about this. So that was hard, getting to a point where I felt that I could let it go.
And I will say that we have had guests on the show that, you know, do 7 rewrites, like, you know, of the first page before they get anywhere. My last question for you is, I want to end on a note asking you what your hopes are for reparations and for a forgiveness act for the future for us in America.
My hope is that we can unite as a country and acknowledge what we did wrong, but also continue to have hope for something better.
Maura Cheeks, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about your new novel, Acts of Forgiveness.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel.
It's been a real pleasure speaking to you, and I really look forward to staying in touch and reading more, as I am sure all of my listeners do too. You've been listening to Check This Out, a new literary series, which is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Howe Library in Hanover, New Hampshire. We dive deeply into the works of emerging and diverse authors you may not have discovered yet. Our producers today are Jared Jenisch, Megan Coleman, and NHPR's Emily Quirk. The Howe Library Director is Ruby Simon. NHPR's Program Director is Emily Quirk. The show is sponsored by the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation, the Howe Library Corporation, and CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies. We are also sponsored by the award-winning novel Holding On to Nothing, which comes out in paperback in May from novelist Elizabeth Childs Shelburne. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, and we'll be back next week at the same time with Leo Vardiashvili, the author of Hard by a Great Forest, a story about a man who fled the Republic of Georgia in the midst of war. A unique story about the traumas of war and the lasting effects of those families driven not just to survive, but to remember, love, and live. Remember to go to your local library and check out all of the books you hear about here and love. Thanks for listening.